Are you an ambitious, driven entrepreneur starting to feel overwhelmed, maybe a little trapped by your business? Well, I have a solution for you. It is the 5-day Bottleneck to Breakthrough Challenge, where in an hour a day, we will give you the roadmap, the blueprint, the treasure map to where you can find yourself with more free time, more freedom of money, and a more valuable business. Hope to see you soon. www.bottlenecktobreakthrough.com. Hello and welcome to The Real Bottom Line, the podcast for entrepreneurs featuring entrepreneurs. And today, my very special guest today is Kathy Bennett. And I'm so excited to have you here, Kathy. Thank you for joining the show today.
Thank you for having me.
Now, Kathy, you are quite the entrepreneur. Some might even give you the title serial entrepreneur. How did you find yourself owning your own businesses? How did that happen?
Well, I had spent coming out of high school. I started working in the restaurant business in the McDonald's franchise. And I spent 17 years there working for other folks, and then decided that my itch to be my own boss and be the owner and being able to execute on my own ideas and the team's ideas, probably in a more fulsome way, it led me to become an owner-operator of, at the time, the largest female joint venture operation in Canada.
That is amazing. We were talking, you know, prior to this interview about just how much you can learn about running a business from the franchise model of McDonald's, because they seem to have everything sorted. Well, what were some of the biggest lessons you learned from operating that franchise, but even just running that as a business?
Well, I think one of the really cool things about working in a franchise that's global, like McDonald's restaurants is you get the benefit of, you know, decades and decades of refinement around operations platforms. So from an execution perspective, it was a really good environment to learn the importance and the value of things like continuous improvement, consistency of standards, training programs, management development programs, and all the tools that were kind of built throughout the decades the franchise had been established to support those pillars. The other thing that the experience gave me, it was an opportunity in a high volume environment to make a lot of rapid fire decisions. So it's really difficult not to make really quick decisions when every lunch hour or every supper hour is, you know, a make it or break it type of experience, and you get to refine your problem solving and your strategic thinking very significantly with that type of intensity of rapid decisions when you're on the restaurant floor as the manager, or when you're running the operation as an operations supervisor or owner operator, as I did.
Yeah, I can remember still to this day. So I worked there as a teenager. I still remember QSCV.
Absolutely.
Quality, service, cleanliness, value. So the training aspect and how it's repeated and all the values are repeated really do sink in. And that must have been an interesting learning as well, just how repetition works.
Well, and I think the wonderful thing is that the repetition for me bled into other companies that I went on to own. So while we had a mission, vision, values inside McDonald's Canada, as an example, and McDonald's globally. We had one for our own franchise, and then subsequently for other companies that I was part of, we had mission, vision, values. And same thing with quality standards, service standards, cleanliness standards. And one of the things that I think I took away from that is the importance of clearly setting objectives early. So everybody can play on the same team. It's really challenging as an entrepreneur, especially entrepreneurs who move quickly. We're having all these ideations about our business, and if our teams aren't on the same pace, it's very difficult for them to execute at the level that we expect execution be if they don't have a clear understanding what the vision and the deliverables are for customers, whether it's a direct-to-consumer or it's a B2B operation or it's an operation serving the public sector. You always want to make sure that your enterprise is focused on the direction of the customer. And McDonald's was a great learning ground for me to understand how to, you know, set a target and then gut check against the customers to see if we were actually delivering.
Oh, fascinating. So when it came to your next ventures, where did you end up and how did you decide? Like, so you're operating McDonald's, you have a number of them under your umbrella. What's next?
So we had some needs that we were fulfilling using other companies. So for example, when we were doing renovations, remodels to the restaurants, we would have to contract that out to a contractor. Over time, we started to take on more small projects internally, and then subsequently, we ended up acting as our own contractor. And then we did some renovations for other folks, so that kind of created that business. We needed some office space, and because we had capacity issues in the restaurants, and that brought me into real estate, and we had some real estate acquisitions, and we created a company that was offering at the time a boutique office space for short-term and long-term rentals in a very unique way. And then we were also working with some international recruitment companies, bringing in welcoming to Canada folks that wanted to come work in our franchise as managers. And I decided that I wanted to partner with that company, and we ended up as a partner in an international recruitment company. Another one, which is a bit more of a maybe a humorous story for your, and a powerful story, I guess, for your listeners. I had a mom call me one day, and her daughter was running a day spa. And the mother, who I knew well from the business circles, wanted me to mentor the young girl. So I agreed to do it. And as I mentored her, I realized this was a really incredibly talented young woman who really should be the owner of this business and wanted to buy it out, but didn't have the capital. So I became a partner with her, and we bought out a day spa. And then subsequently, I sold my shares back to her many years later. So it was you know, kind of a similar path that I walked when I didn't have the capital. But ultimately, a partnership was an opportunity for me to partner with McDonald's Canada to make the purchase. And in her case, the partnership with me allowed her to have her dream.
Well, that's interesting. So very much like a vertical integration, so that you were controlling even more of your, you know, ecosystem, if you will. Mm-hmm. For all your, the words, all your needs, all your business needs.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Has that been kind of the way that you proceeded? Like, did you ever go beyond that into different places with it when you were
doing
your business like that?
We did. I did grow into a industrial construction fabrication company where I was a minority partner. And that was based on some opportunities that I felt were available in the region. And we had some capital that we wanted to deploy. And I thought it would be, you know, it would be an extension of the commercial construction work that we were doing in some regards. I think that, you know, for me, if I think back, was there a common thread amongst all of it? For me, it was around opportunity. And just like I kind of had waited a long time to become a McDonald's operator, not because I wanted to wait, but because the system was not ready for me, and the right sale didn't manifest itself. Once that sale happened and I became a joint venture and then subsequently bought McDonald's Canada out, I got really aggressive on opportunity. And, you know, where I saw an opportunity that financially made sense, and where our team had the capacity to expand, we expanded because it provided more opportunities for that team. And I really, that was the one thing for me that was so important, was the people.
Right. Yeah. I've talked to some like Tim Hortons franchise owners, and they said at some point it just becomes a people game in terms of finding the right people, training them, retaining them, keeping them engaged. It becomes the primary focus.
Yeah, and I think if folks, I mean, like I wanted to be challenged in my own role as I moved from a joint venture, you know, a supervisor, a general manager into an owner-operator's position where I had a joint venture and then subsequently bought out the company, my team members wanted the same upward mobility. So if we became stagnant, then the opportunities for them became stagnant. So if you're going to attract really good talent, part of attracting good talent is making sure that you can continue to, you know, stretch them and they can achieve what they want to achieve at the same time as you're achieving what you want to achieve.
You talked a bit about opportunities that you see. So what was the lens? What were the criteria or the filter you used to analyze an opportunity that made you go, yep, this is for me, or not so much?
Yeah, so typically the first filter would have been, can I make a difference? So is there something I can see on the surface? And the surface, I think for folks that look at businesses, we all see different things on the surface. But I always judged if I could see something on the surface that I knew I could make an impact on, or that with, you know, some subtle changes would you know, make a step change in the company. That to me was a really good test. Secondarily was the financials. I made sure I had really strong CFOs that worked with me. Because for me, I was not necessarily the person you'd ask about risk. I was the person you'd ask about reward. So I needed to have an internal business partner in my CFO who could comfortably challenge whether or not the investment or the acquisition or the sale even made good financial sense. And lots of times I could see the opportunity. I didn't always see the financial risk. And that's why early on I realized that I needed to have these folks that can put the riverbanks around us entrepreneurs as we're racing ahead, so that we get right to the cliff and we stop before we go right over the cliff.
One of my favorite quotes is, if you work for a yes man, one of you is redundant. So
yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I love that you had that ability to build team in a way that might be counterintuitive to some, because you're actually looking for people who will be contrarian to you. Yeah. If it makes sense.
Oh, 100%. I mean, part of the McDonald's management development training, a number of different leadership styles were ones that I felt very comfortable with. And, you know, I was used to making rapid decisions, and some decisions in business shouldn't be made rapidly, right? So having folks that are more thoughtful in that they take a little bit more time would also allow me to take a little bit more time, which was helpful. So finding, you know, people who had different skills that could smooth out our executive team, whether it was a chief legal officer, chief financial officer, whether it's a chief operations officer, we wanted those skills to be different, but also complementary, filling gaps. And we did profiles of all of us, and we shared them with each other. So folks knew what, you know, strengths and weaknesses were. You know, I would tend to be the one that was called in a crisis, because I was, you know, able to make a decision expeditiously and process a lot of information fast. Whereas, you know, my CFO knew that there was no deal going to happen ever unless the CFO signed off on it, because that was a commitment I made to them. And it was helpful for me to have people who knew that I trusted them, and that the decision was going to be a collective decision. It wasn't going to be just solely my decision. We made better decisions because of it.
Where did you find your people?
Some of them were in our internal team that I knew over a long period of time and provided opportunities to develop. On the financial side, I'd often lean on my external financial advisors for recommendations. We would, you know, when we had some turnover, we'd interview extensively and do a lot of reference checks. And I typically, because I had a lot of interviewing experience, I think over my career, there was 4,000 people I worked with. So, you know,
You are good.
It was really important for me to have a lot of one-on-one time with key, you know, C-suite executives that we brought in. And usually the CFO was external, CLO was external, and COO often was somebody that was internal or had grown up in the McDonald's systems, because the McDonald's portion of our business was a significant part of our overall company.
Yeah, and you do have to understand their magic and their methods for that, for sure. When have you divested yourself from all of those core businesses that you had at one point acquired?
Yeah, so over time, a couple of years I did in public service, we divested of all of those enterprises. It was really important for me to give opportunities to, for example, that young young woman who purchased the day spa, right, to make sure that she had the full share structure back in her treasury as opposed to be sharing it with me. And it was also really important. I worked with the previous operator for 17 years, six of which he was trying to sell his business. And it was not a pleasant time, wasn't a happy time. It was a very difficult time for the employees. So I swore I would never do that to my team. So when the time came for us to make a decision, we made it, we executed it, and we had built a pipeline of buyers that helped us execute that in a way that didn't take 6 years.
Talk to me more about a pipeline of buyers. What did you look for in a buyer? Because obviously your people are important to you. So I would assume that that would be part of your qualification process for buyers as well.
Well, and in a franchise system, it's not like a marriage, right? You don't get to pick your partner. You have to have, it's an arranged marriage because your franchisor has to approve the partner. So it does take time to build somebody in your business area who will be approved by the national franchisor. And in my case, we were lucky enough that we had a person that we had sold a restaurant to quite strategically who demonstrated really strong skills to McDonald's Canada, and over time he gained their confidence to be able to buy out the business. So it was, while it didn't seem like to our team members that it took 6 years, it definitely happened over the course of 5 or 6 years, but we planned it well in advance.
Amazing. With regards to thinking about planning for the future and for planning to sell, what do you think is the runway that most business owners should be considering?
Well, I think to build your pipeline of buyers, in my case, I talked to my accountant and lawyer the day the joint venture deal closed with McDonald's Canada and told them that their number one job was to make me accountable to prepping the business for a sale. And that was 20 plus years before we actually sold. I think the day you buy a business, you should really be thinking about it, because at some point, whether through an emergency or a crisis or for planning reasons, that time is inevitable. And I think what we all too often see is folks that wait and avoid that planning and then end up in a situation where there is a crisis or they get tired and weary, and we all kind of wear down as entrepreneurs, and we can't find a pipeline of buyers. And a pipeline of buyers for me are, you know, folks that are in the same business, similar businesses who might want to grow their own. So industry associations where you're hanging out with folks that do the same things you do are really helpful. Franchisee organizations like we had were really helpful. You have to find like-minded folks who are interested in the same type of business operations that you actually are running. And that helps with the pipeline. On the planning side, building the value of your business and making sure that from a debt perspective, you're not taking on debt at times in your business cycle where it doesn't make sense or it's going to impact a sale price. Those are things you understand. And in our case, we actually used an evaluations person to help us ensure that in the last year, we weren't leaving anything kind of undone on the balance sheet or the income statement that, should have been a little tighter. And the last thing I'd say is, you've got to always run your business lean. And I don't mean, I purposely said not mean and lean, because I do think there's a difference. When I say lean, if you've gotten comfortable over the years of, being happy with really high marketing sales, but that your industry doesn't necessarily think that, that's not necessarily a value that the industry has, then you really got to scale that back at a time so your potential buyer can see that over the course of a couple of years and see the difference that not spending those dollars make. You have to make the profit and loss statement present to a potential buyer in a way that their bank is going to lend them money. Because really, a buyer is only able to buy if they can convince their bank that it's a company that can make some money.
Such a great point, in the sense that if you're trying to maybe even update your numbers or change your numbers in such a way so that you're not taking a lot of money out of your company so that you can reduce your taxes, that can affect your buyer and yourself mm-hmm. when you go forward, because bankers are typically, I don't find many of them that are thinking out of the box and can understand that piece.
I think you owe your buyer a set of historical financials, at least for a couple of years, that can demonstrate that the company can be affordable at the price that you're asking for, whether it's an asset sale or share sale, it doesn't matter. But I think sometimes as buyers, we often forget that, the seller on the other side is going to have to do the exact same thing we did when we bought the business. And we need to make sure that they've got a story to go tell their bank. Otherwise, it's really difficult. And in our case, we closed the restaurant deal on the 17th of March, 2020. And had the bank, had the buyer's bank not had really clear visibility into consistent financials, I'm not sure we would have closed. So, I don't suspect there's many in your listening audience that are going to have to face a pandemic the week that they close a business transaction, but stuff happens. And that's the why you had to have that consistency of financial performance so that you can give the buyer the material they need to go leverage themselves to buy the business.
Well, and you bring up such good points. Like if you were operated your business every day as if tomorrow someone might want to buy it, that would affect your decisions and how you structure things. And when you look at some of the statistics that say, up to 50% of businesses transition involuntarily, death, divorce, disability, etc., being ready will mean that there's not money left on the table for your family.
Well, and it was interesting in my case, Wendy, that my first business transaction was actually the sale of a business, because that's exactly what happened to my dad. He passed away while he was in the process of selling the business, so I had to do that first deal. And this was all at the time I was waiting for my boss in the McDonald's world to sell a business for 6 years. And to me, it's so important that you have a strategic approach towards the exit, because the mm-hmm. exit, as you just said, it can happen at any time, even when you don't want it to happen. It may need to happen.
So we kind of glided over this. However, I think an interesting part of your journey is that you did get into politics and actually were the finance minister for Newfoundland. What made you decide to go serve that way?
For me, we had been really privileged with, exceptionally loyal crew, team members, and customers. And for me, I thought that public office was a way of giving back to the broader community. I thought I had learned some things inside the business and also in my personal life and my volunteer life that would have been helpful. And I was anxious to give back. And it was a real privilege to do that. Those decisions don't come without other costs. But in retrospect, as a family, mm-hmm. we still are very glad that it was a decision that I was able to do for 5 years.
That's amazing. Such a different way of being. Like, we think politics is just like running a business, but there's, I think, so many more different stakeholders and pressures that we're not aware of as business owners.
Yeah. And I think, there's, public offices, public service, although there are financial similarities in some cases to, how the bond rating agencies or how banking syndicates may want to, put together your debt for the provincial treasury. At the end of the day, it's not the same thing as a transaction where there's a customer and a supplier. Governments roles are about creating policy that help populations thrive, survive and thrive, some people would say. And I think that's a delicate balance of thoughtful decisions that folks need to make. So kudos to all those folks that are still on the field, as we say, serving in municipal, provincial, and federal governments, wherever they may be serving.
It's not easy, particularly as a woman in that field either. Mm-hmm.
It's very challenging. I think, for most folks that are listening, they would appreciate that, it's a tough, tough role for a woman. And that's why, I was really pleased to do it. And I'm also happy to be retired from it now.
So well, your latest venture, Kathy, that I'm aware of for the bigger one, is really intriguing and really interesting, and that is Sandpiper. Mm-hmm. What is Sandpiper? How did it come to be?
So Sandpiper Ventures is a venture capital firm that's based in Atlanta, Canada. We invest in early stage startups at the pre-seed, seed, and maybe Series A stage. And these companies are founded by women or have women in the C-suite who are also own meaningful equity in the company. Mm-hmm. We invest in companies that are trying to solve the biggest problems of the world today. And only 2% of venture capital money actually ends up with women generally. And those stats have been stagnant now for at least the last 5 years, 6 years that I've been working in VC. And in some respects, if I think back to my first experience borrowing money, and then I add what I learned when I was minister responsible for status of women on the access to capital challenges that women entrepreneurs generally have, I don't think I think the pathway to where I am today is a straight line. And I'm really privileged to be able to work with the founders and the investors that trust us with the money that they invest in our fund so we can invest it in women-founded enterprises.
Why do you think that is? I know it's a big question, but I'm always curious about if there's an answer that you think is the reason for women not being funded properly.
Well, I think some would say that there's existing connections in an ecosystem that are already built, sometimes through hundreds and hundreds of years and relationships that are built. And it's tough if you're not in those conversations, it's tough to be considered. What we try to do is to change the way founders are supported, these female founders are supported, by supporting them even more on the fundraising side so they can raise that next round with us. And I think, ultimately, to call it out, I mean, there is bias in decision-making. We know research will tell us that women are asked more risk questions than they are asked growth questions. And that changes how investors hear your pitch. If you're only talking about the risks for an hour versus talking about the growth for an hour, somebody's desire to part way with their own capital to invest in your business is going to be different. If I think back to how brazen I was when I went to the bank to ask for money for the joint venture, I had 17 years of experience, so there was no risk question that somebody was asking me that I didn't that I didn't think was trivial. So when the banks were asking me about risk, I was making it trivial because to me I was more excited about the growth.
Right.
But if that had happened to me when I was in my first year, I would have definitely been answering a lot of the risk questions. And I think that the systems are built in a way that don't allow women to talk about growth of their companies in a way that is typical. And I'm always excited when founders are talking about, their inventions or their technology, and you see the passion coming through. To me, that's what we invest in. That confidence in the problem they're solving.
I love that. Solve the biggest problems in the world. Can you give us one example of a company you've invested in?
Sure. This one is because I met with her a few minutes ago. She's a ICU nurse who happens to have also a Bachelor of Business Administration. She's mm-hmm. from Pasadena, Newfoundland. Deanne McCarthy is her name. And she has developed a technology to be used in the ICU that will significantly reduce the rates of infection for intubated patients. And her invention, which she created during COVID, is just now in clinical trials in the U.S. And we're super excited to see what her compassionate nursing skills and her experience as a nurse coupled with her business acumen is going to mean to patient survival rates in the ICU and folks getting in and out of the ICU without picking up infections.
Oh, that is so interesting. And so you've bought businesses, you've sold businesses, you've served in the government, and now you're kind of almost like helping another whole new generation of owners leverage and get off their feet and really amplify the work they're doing. When you look back on that, what is the common thread in terms of what is your zone of genius? Like, what are you the best at that no one else does it the way you do it?
Well, I think I'll share with you what people tell me and not necessarily what I think, because that's two different things. What people will tell me is that I see stuff sometimes before other people see it. Mm-hmm. And I suspect that has more to do with things like around operations and strategy. And it goes back to the early learning that I had as a shift manager in the McDonald's in a very, very disciplined, very, very, we had great training. We had, great opportunities to build our leadership skills. And we participated in, quarterly strategic planning. Like this was a big part of the work that we did as managers, both junior managers and senior managers. And I think for me, that ability to see faster is sometimes rooted in that experience. And now, I regularly have folks say, Kathy, I would have never ever thought of that idea. And I'm like, well, we thought about it every quarter, right? So it's, I don't know if it's unique. It's unique to me. I think I'm privileged because of the training I've had. And I think that's what some would say is my zone of genius.
Absolutely. And it's interesting when we find the zone of genius, we're so good at it. We almost think everybody is, mm-hmm. and we just tend to discount sometimes that ability.
Absolutely. And it's, it's certainly fun and exciting to recognize, I think, what your zone of genius is, and also recognize others in your orbit for their zone of genius. And I think back to our earlier conversation about my CFOs, CLOs, and COOs. Yeah. I was so blessed to have their zone of genius, keeping us focused and not necessarily relying solely on my own. Because you see it quick doesn't mean you see it right. So.
Oh, there's a mic drop right there.
Sometimes you luck out. About 80% of the time, I'm probably okay. But the other 20%, there's other cues that you miss. And I think that's where you need to have a rounded up team that is built with a bunch of geniuses.
Well, Kathy, I have to say thank you so much for your time today. There were so many great lessons, I think, that you imparted about your journey and what you learned along the way. And so I know our listeners got a lot out of it. But I think the real bottom line here today is when the day after you buy a business or start a business is the day you start to plan your sale. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Kathy.
Thank you.